Dr. Ray Lash. He's with the VA Maine Healthcare System in Augusta, Maine. And Dr. Lash is the Associate Chief of Staff for Education for VA Maine. He's helped to establish the Training and Education Institute in Lewiston, Maine. And after a 25-year career in private practice as an interventional, I'm assuming that's cancer, it got cut off.
Cardiology,
very sorry. The other C problem, joined the VA in Maine. He grew up in rural Kansas. He attended a one-room, thank you, James, for throwing me totally off my game. He attended a one-room schoolhouse with an outdoor bathroom. Somebody was killed in a farming accident. I'll let you talk about that because it got cut off. I'm so sorry. The website from which I got to print these automatically set my margins, so it cut off half the material. But at any rate, the death that he will tell you about gave him a deep understanding of the challenges of rural public health and healthcare. And that's what Dr. Lash will talk to you about today.
Thank you very much. The death that she was referring to is the death of my father. My father went to the same one-room country schoolhouse that I did in rural Kansas. I've practiced in rural Kansas. I have subsequently moved to Maine, and all of that was an attempt to establish my bona fides in the fact that I do know something and have an interest in rural health care and in education. My predecessors here have made an excellent case that we need to do something about access for care in rural health. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about is not that we need to do these things, but what have we done? First off, I do have federal support. I'm from the federal government. I'm here to help. Which also means I have four times as many disclaimers as anybody else has. This material is based upon work supported by the Office of Rural Health and the Office of Academic Affiliations of the Veterans Health Administration. The contents do not include personally identifiable information. The contents do not represent the views of the Department of Veterans Affairs or the United States government, and I also have no financial relationships to disclose. We've already gone through the rural health areas. I am from right there, that little part of eastern Kansas, and grew up on a dairy farm. Now I am from right around there, and I would just like to point out that Maine is poor, and we are underserved, but we're cold, too. We've already made the case that we need to provide more access to care. So one of the things that has happened is that we have worked very hard and diligently to try to do something about that access. And so we have been considering what we can do to bring educational access to the rural areas of the United States and Maine in particular. If you begin to think about how we're going to do this, you begin to have these parameters that become paramount in your internal calculations. You have to have a need, a mission, a vision. What is it that we're trying to do and why do we need to do it? Do you have trainees that would be interested in what you're doing? Do you have faculty that can teach the people that you want to train? Do you have a facility that can do that with you? Do you have academic affiliates that are interested in your projects and interested in supporting you? And finally, is there a curriculum and accreditation issues that you have to be concerned about as you are working through this? This is a map of the state of Maine, and the pertinent points I want to point out is that in Maine, most people live in this general area. This is Augusta, the capital. This is Portland, the largest city in Maine, and to tell you how big it is, Portland has about 60,000 people in it. Okay. To put that in perspective, if you go up here to Clayton Lake has a population of 7, right? A town with a population of 7 makes the map in Maine, right? go back. The other thing I wanted to point out is a little bit about VA Maine healthcare system. Many of you are not familiar with the VA system, and I'll talk some more about that. But VA Maine is responsible for the entire healthcare of all of the veteran population that we care for in the state of Maine. VA Maine is built up of predominantly a relatively large campus, the Togus campus. A Togus campus is a very interesting place. It is historic. It is the original VA that was developed in the United States. It was commissioned by Abraham Lincoln about 30 days before he died, and it fulfills the mission of Abraham Lincoln to care for those who have borne the battle, their widows and their orphans. So we have a long history. So Togus is about here, and we have various clinics scattered throughout the state, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. What about the veteran population? There's somewhere around 22 million veterans in the United States. About 30% of those reside in rural and highly rural areas. Highly rural areas are those areas that have less than 7 people per square mile. Okay? You could put the whole town of Clayton Lake in one of those places. About 3 million veterans are enrolled in the VA. About half of those are between the ages of 55 and 74. 26% are over 75 years, and they're older than the urban veterans that we take care of. About 28% of all female veterans are enrolled, and Maine has around 135,000 veterans, 50,000 of which are enrolled, and 40,000 rather, currently use the VA system. 81% of the veterans in the state of Maine are either rural or highly rural. I won't go over this slide just to point out that we got blue and green like you guys do too. And that was with primary care and in mental health. Why do we care? War's hard on small towns. This is a picture of Joanna Hawthorne from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. This is her son's grave. She has been visiting, was visiting her son's grave every day for over a year. After the first year, she backed off a little bit, now visits it only once a week or so. But the point I wanted to make is that hometowns of under 25,000 people send nearly half the people that die in war, right? So the VA is really interested in what happens in rural health. What other kinds of things do we note? We note that veterans, particularly rural veterans, are getting older and they're getting sicker. And the challenges for care for access to these people is even more if you're isolated and more rural than if you live someplace nearer. We have real issues in the VA Maine system with distances to care. Okay, our primary referral base from VA Maine is Boston. Okay, it's 260 miles from Togus to Fort Kent. I didn't show you Fort Kent. Fort Kent is clear at the top, but Maine is about 330 miles tall and about 220 miles wide. Fort Kent is up there. I can drive to New York City from Togus faster than I can drive to Fort Kent. Okay. The other thing that's interesting is that VA Maine is responsible for all aspects of care for our veterans, including transportation. What does that mean? That means if you are in a rural area in Maine and you are cared for at Fort Kent and you need, for example, an appointment with an ear, nose, and throat physician, you got to drive 5 hours to get there. If that ear, nose, and throat physician says you need to see a subspecialist, then you got to get to Boston. So what does that mean? We have patients driving 5 or 6 hours to get to Togus. They spend the night. They get on the bus at Togus. They drive down to Boston, and Boston is very gracious to us. They have standing appointments for our patients at 11 and 12 and 1 in the middle of the day. So they got time to come down, get on the bus, get back home, spend the night in Togus again, and then finally go back home. So it is a significant problem. There are some other interesting things about the VA system that make our system a little bit different than the regular system. We are a single payer system, right? Not all veterans are eligible for care. Our primary mission is to serve those service-connected veterans. And what that means is those veterans who have an injury or an illness that is attributable to their service. Okay? But we also have a social mission. Part of the social contract we make with people that enter our military is that you take care of us, you fight our battles, when you get home, we will take care of you. Okay? So we are the payers of last resort for those veterans who have not been able to establish circumstances that allow them to pay for their own care. Okay? And then finally, there are some special rules. Veterans of conflicts of the recent wars can be signed up within 5 years of leaving the service. Many of the rules of VA healthcare are determined at the federal rather than state level. And since we're not fee-for-service, we have, quote, less emphasis on billing. We commented earlier that I spent my career predominantly in private practice and as an interventional cardiologist, okay? One of the things that we did all of the time as an interventional cardiologist, for example, was manage an anticoagulation clinic, right? And if you're in private practice of cardiology and you're trying to pay the help, you need to do everything you can do to increase your revenue. That meant that I had to take care of my own anticoagulation patients, right? When I moved to the VA, they didn't do it that way. They have a pharmacist who does that. And I thought, that's crazy. How could they possibly do as well as I do at managing anticoagulation? And they said, it's okay, we'll take care of it. And I said, well, okay, let me see how that goes. And then they said, and we'll be the guy that calls them back at 6 o'clock on Friday night because they didn't get the INR back. And I said, sign me up, okay? Right. So these pharmacists, not only do they do it really, really well, but they do it all the time. And in fact, they do it better than I can do it. Okay. So we allow our professionals to practice at the top of the heap, and we don't have to worry about whether or not they can bill in the traditional method. Okay. For example, most psychotherapy that's done within the VA system is done not by psychiatrists, but by other kinds of mental health providers. So, for example, what am I talking about when I talk about telepharmacy? This is that a map of the state of Maine again. Here is Togus, up here by Augusta. Okay, we have four big, forgive us, we use acronyms for everything, CBOX, community-based outpatient clinics. Okay, and they are located up here in Bangor. It's pronounced Bangor. Okay, the Lewiston-Auburn area, and down here in Saco and Biddeford. We have a pharmacist here in Lewiston that is managing anticoagulation up here in Rumford and here in Lincoln and here in Calais. Right. I know it's Calais, but we call it Calais, okay? welcome to Maine. So that's the way our telepharmacy program works, right? Some of that telepharmacy is done by simple phone calls, but large portions of it are done by CVT, clinical video teleconferencing, right? Because we know that if you talk to the pharmacist either in person, face-to-face, or the pharmacist is a guy on the other side of that box who's also looking in you in the eye by teleconferencing, you pay attention and we get a better result. One of the other things that happens within the VA system is that we are very oriented towards the patient-centered medical home, but of course we call it something different. We call it the patient-aligned care team, right? And the patient-centered medical home, the PACS, instead of having an individual physician take care of an individual patient, we have a team of people that are responsible for the care of that patient. Okay, so the way that that looks in our system, and really I think in most systems, is that we have a primary care team here, and they are the primary source of contact for those patients, but they are surrounded and supported by lots of other people, case managers, social workers, administrative, and whatever. And no amount of care can live in a vacuum. So other things are also extremely important. Family, right? How are you going to take care of somebody who's got an illness if they're spending the money because their kid is sick instead, right? So family, community, all of those resources become important. So our PACT, Patient Medical Centered Home, at large site then, is predominantly revolving around this primary care team. Okay, but if you happen to live in Calais, you don't have that team of 8 or 10 people. You got 3 or 4 people, right? And it's been extremely exacerbated by the things that we've been talking about here all day. So the question then comes up, how are we going to deal? Whoa. I killed it. I don't know. But it's back. He's back. So. No, I hope not. So how are we going to deal with this? And thanks to the foresight of many of our people, we talk about awkward things about our leadership in Washington, D.C., but some people get it right. And frankly, I think most of the time, in spite of all the news that you hear, the VA gets it right. Right? It's not the same organization I trained with in 1976. Okay? It's much better. Among the people that get it right are Dr. Hetler, who works with the Office of Academic Affiliations in the back, and she was responsible for a part of what we've been doing with this whole Associated Health thing. So people really work. So the Office of Rural Health, who's responsible for rural health, and the Office of Academic Affiliations got together, and they said, what are we going to do to improve access to care in rural Maine? And they devised a project called the Rural Health Training and Education Initiative. And they sent out grant proposals, and we wrote one, and we were fortunate enough to get it. So we do training in rural areas for rural health providers for rural health care. What are the goals of the RHTI? To develop sustainable models of rural health training. To expand the presence for physician and associated, you'd call it allied health, trainees in rural and highly rural states. Enhance recruitment and retention, and eventually to enhance veterans' access to care. I should point out that when we think of medical education, we sometimes go back to the old model, the way that we were trained, the way that I was trained in medical school. I spent 2 years at the University of Kansas doing lots of Kansas people here today. At the University of Kansas in medical school, learning pharmacology and physiology and anatomy, physiology, all of those kinds of things. And then after we did that, then I went out and I did my clinical training. There are big differences between the basic sciences training and clinical training. Okay? The basic sciences training tend to be more didactic. They tend to lend themselves to somebody standing up here at the podium and some people in the back sleeping. They tend to lend themselves to large classes, and they have a large trainee to teacher ratio. But when we start talking about clinical things, it's different. There's more individually patient-based. The important part is not what room am I in, but what patient, what veteran am I seeing, and how am I modeling the interaction between myself and that patient based on whoever I'm fortunate enough to have work with me. Okay? It's less centralized, more frequently one-on-one, and more focused on the patient than the place. So one of the things that we wanted to do in order to enhance the ability for ourselves to recruit and retain people was to try to move education out to the sites, right? Maine, again, is blessed with rurality, all right? Other than Bangor, Lewiston, Auburn, and Portland, all the rest of Maine is either is rural or highly rural, right? And we have put the primary sites of these educational programs out in our rural areas. The primary home of that is in the Lewiston-Auburn Seebach, and where we have there, we have started with a formal telemedicine training center. Among the things we do is that we work with the Northeast Telehealth Resource Center, who is a consortium that works within six states in New England, New York, Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Mass, no, I can't remember. Six states in New England, okay? And I've offended them. We used to work with the Northeast Telehealth Resource Center, and we have put on training classes for telepresenters at our LA Seebach, right? The Office of Rural Health was generous to us. They funded us three sets of equipment so that we have trainee stations there, have a room about this size. I can have you in the back being the telepresenter and you being the attending, and you guys are going great guns, and I'll pull a cord, right? What do you do if you're the patient and the video goes out, right? What do you do when the power goes off? What do you do, and God forbid, you have a patient who's in being seen for mental health, something that has a crisis, and now you have some patient that's potentially suicidal or violent, and you're in Calais, and you got four people there, right? So those are all the kinds of things that we work with. The other thing that's happened, again, with Dr. Hetler's support from the OAA, we have developed stipends, right? If you want people to come train, give them some money, right? It works really well for us. So we were able to develop stipend-supported programs of family medicine nurse practice, optometry, which we actually migrated from the TOGAS campus, but then we developed other programs from scratch, including neuropsychology, rural pharmacy, and telemental health. Any of those things come up in the conversations that we've already had? We're paying attention. We also believe, like the field of dreams, if you build it, they will come. And in fact, it does. So we have done other things like internal VA staff training. We worked with the University of New England, AHEC. AHEC, yeah, I know, that part I got. It's the rest of the words that do. Area Health Education Councils, that's it. Centers, the C word. And we are working to develop various venues for educational things that they are doing. So among the next phase of what we're doing through the RHTI, the AHEC is putting on content with curriculum that they have that we're going to send to the road. Okay, we'll send them to Calais. We'll send them to Holton. We're doing interprofessional education. We're working with medical residents, medical students, social workers, and a whole bunch of people. The other things that we're doing are program specific. So, for example, we are teaching telepharmacy. We have a telepharmacist there, and we have people from the University of New England School of Pharmacy working on that. We have developed we're in the process of developing. We advertised to the ORH that we could get this done in a year, but we couldn't. But they were gracious enough to let us have another year, and we're still going to get another year to put in an official rural pharmacy residency. Okay, we're working on telemental health. And then one of the things that I'm really excited about is we're working on the potential for remote consultations. Let me digress just a second. If I ask you to close your eyes and think about a veteran returning from war, I bet one of the images that would come in your mind would be a veteran who potentially has PTSD or traumatic brain injury. Those are now the signature injuries of our current conflict, right? One of the things that we're trying to do is keep it so those people who are in Fort Kent or Calais or Holton don't have to come 5 hours to be seen, to be evaluated by a neuropsychologist. Right, and imagine what that's like if you're a 75-year-old veteran or anybody else, and you need an evaluation for whether or not you have mental capacity to make your decisions. It's no problem. We got a neuropsychologist. Get in the car, about three or so, I would think, and drive to Togas. It'll take you about 5 hours to get down there, and then we're going to give you a battery of mental tests, and then we're going to go over your evaluation with you, and we're going to decide if you have mental capacity or not. Right? I think there are problems with that. One of the things that we're working hard to do is to use telemedicine not only for medicine but for teleeducation, right? If a pharmacist can see a patient using telemedicine, then I can talk to my student using that same kind of equipment. And so we've worked to develop to move pedagogy out of the academic affiliations classroom and into our sites, okay? So we have a renal fellow on the TOGAS campus that at least three times a week dials into what's going on at the Portland Renal Rounds, right? So we're moving those things. The questions that we come up with, and I'm sorry, I'm going long, is whether or not we have trainees. So we say, we're going to build this program. Is anybody interested in coming? Are we getting the right ones? And we also found out relatively early that graduate medical aid trainees are tougher than associated health. Part of that, it relates to the location of the schools. Here's the state of Maine again. Here are our two medical schools. University of New England has a School of Osteopathic Medicine, about 125 students, and Maine Medical Center Tufts has a brand new program that's got about 30 allopathic medical students, right? But these people and the residencies they are associated with are relatively tightly bound to the institution. So, for example, a family medicine resident during their residency has to have a continuity clinic, and they have to have a continuity clinic. They had to go back to Portland to do that. Okay, so that may or may not be so easy, and distance becomes important. Okay. We try to get around that. You know, they have to pay for gas. We got them houses, but VA Maine is the oldest VA in the world, and we got lead paint, right? So you can stay for 90 days, and you got to get out, or you get lead poisoning, right? There are also, and I only wish I were kidding. And you hate to have a graduate who's got lead brain. You know, that's poor form. There are also some challenges of working within the VA system. We are behind the government firewall, and security is profound. Okay, internet access within the VA is challenging. You'll be going along, I'm working on this talk, I'm about there, and I'm going to go to this website and get this piece of information. You can't get there from there, right? So there are challenges. Cell phone coverage is spotty in Maine, and there's a perception of social and intellectual isolation, hard to imagine. So we asked the question, are our trainees rural? Are we going for people that have, did we load the dice properly? Right, and I will argue that I think we're doing an okay job of that. This is a map of the state of Maine. Point out this kind of thing on the left here. These are our largest cities, Portland, 66,000, then it drops down to 36,000, 33,000, etc. Okay, these are arrows represents where our trainees come from. We think we're getting trainees that have a high likelihood of being interested in rural care. If you look at where these people really come from, the majority of them come from communities of less than 10,000 people, right? We're doing our best to load the dice. What about faculty? Do we have faculty members? Are they interested in teaching? What's keeping them from doing it now? What kinds of barriers are there? Do we have a curriculum? Are we going to have challenges with academic affiliates to say, why do you want to take them all the way out to Lewiston? That's too far away. And what we found is that, yes, indeed, we do have faculty. In fact, we had an optometrist on site at the Bangor CBOC who, under the guidance of the optometry program at TOGAS and in affiliation with the New England School of Optometry based here in Boston, we now have, we think, the farthest north optometry resident in the continental United States. Okay, brand new program. We had a family medicine nurse practice person who was interested in teaching, had been teaching, but now we've given them stipends. So we've gone from one trainee to 8 or 10. Okay, we had a rural pharmacist who had been the guy that, you know, please let me develop a program. And he's developed the program. And then we moved some programs, telemental health and neuropsychology. All of our faculty are fully qualified. Most of them were already teaching, and frankly, we didn't have any trouble with accreditation. Nobody fussed with us. They don't care. They're hungry for clinical sites. We're happy to come along. And in fact, the most common response was, I'm glad you asked. I like to teach, but I didn't think I could do it here at TOGAS. Okay. We also did some cool stuff. I am from the federal government. We don't have any money either. One of the things that we did was to work with the University of New England to get a walk without compensation pharmacist. They have a school of pharmacy without compensation, free. The best words, even if you're a government worker, free, right? So they had a pharmacy. They had a batch of students. They got no people to train with. Right, so match made in heaven. So we have that pharmacist who works in our CBOC 2 days a week, taking care of our patients, brings with her a passel of pharmacy trainees, and we're off to the races. Okay, we do the CBT medical education, we do interprofessional education, and we work with a lot of things. Again, we're thinking about what about the facility? What, you know, do you have a place? Well, again, we're dealing with clinical rather than non-clinical training. We do have a nice classroom, kind of like this, but it's not mandatory because most of the clinical education is you and me and that patient in a single room. Okay, and if I'm doing it by telemedicine, it didn't even have to be here. And by that I mean you and I have to be in the same room, but the patient, but we can be anywhere compared to where the parishioner is. We do have adequate physical instruction. You've got to have good internet and telemedicine technology. We use the telemedicine equipment for teleeducation. And one of the great things about working in the VA, our veterans love working with trainees. I have been working at the VA Maine for about 5 years. I have been teaching essentially full-time. All of that time, I can count on one hand the number of veterans who said, nah, I don't really want to work with that student. It just doesn't happen. You can't read this. I know you can't read this. What I want to point out is that our experience to date, we have 35 trainees that have gone through our program, and we have 6,600 hours of training that's taken place through our HTI. So we think that there are some things that are working. What we're hoping to find out as we evaluate on is other things like training information, career choice. Are they interested in joining us afterwards? Are they interested in staying with us? If you as a faculty member want to teach, are you more likely to stay with us since you can teach where you couldn't before, and all of those things. These are the measures that we're going to be looking at to help sort that out. And these are the things that I do think I know, right? Like Donald Rumsfeld, there are those things that we know, and then there are things that we think we know, and then there are those things that we don't know that we don't know. And I think I messed that up, but you get the point. It's one of my favorite quotes, actually. We do know that there's demand for clinical teaching in rural areas. Every program that we offered training in is full, right? Just to put it in perspective, we are way over full on the Tougas campus. We got student nurses working the third shift because there's no other place for them to do training on the campus, right? And we turn away probably at least as many people for clinical training as we can accept. There are trainees who are interested in training. There are faculty available to teach. Curriculum and accreditation seems to be modest issues, and medical residents are more difficult to place than associated health trainees. And that's what I learned about that. So thank you very much.
I'm losing my ribbons. I feel like I'm getting undressed. Okay, but I'm not. So those of you who are standing, please feel free to come on and have a seat while we take questions for our panel discussion, if you'd like. Thanks very much. One more hand for our speakers, please. So I know I've learned a lot about this whole area today, and we'd like to open it up for questions. Please ask whomever you'd like. Anybody? Okay, go ahead.
She asked about the stipend supported program. Stipends are like salaries, except they're really not. Okay, and so the Office of Academic Affiliation has offered us permanent stipends. What that means is then, is for example, our family medicine nurse practice trainees who are in their final year of training before they're going out on their own, we can pay them while they are training. You're not really paid. What we're doing is giving you money so you don't have to worry about making money while you're in training. Okay, so it's a little bit different. To the trainees, it's very much the same. You still got to pay taxes. You still got to pay Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a difference for that. Okay, and again, through the generosity of the Office of Academic Affiliations, they gave us seven new trainee slots, including family medicine, nurse practice, optometry, rural pharmacy, neuropsychology, and telemental health. Okay, we also have already other programs that we're going to hit them up for later on. Does it have to meet minimum wage? I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that, for example, a first year psychology resident who is probably about as low on the financial reimbursement scale as they can be is somewhere around $28,000 or $29,000. So it's probably above minimum wage. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. One of the challenges we have in New York State, that's where I'm from, for those of you who are not familiar with New York State, 43 of the 62 counties are rural, just to give that perspective. One of the challenges we have, we're very much interested in the e-health, the telehealth components, but the challenges we have are no reimbursement structure that's in place to enable us to take on these tasks. How were you able to?
If I might answer that, the question is, how do we deal with reimbursement? We get a check from the federal government. It's a different world. It's a different world. I think that the thing that's interesting to me and what I tell the residents is we are going to have one of two systems, maybe, or some kind of a blend of systems for healthcare in the United States as we progress on down the years. One of them is probably close to what we're doing now, and one of them is close to what the VA is doing. I don't know which one it's going to be, but that's part. Having said that, the state of Maine is relatively progressive about reimbursement for telemedicine things, and that's where it comes from, so that you can be reimbursed for that. Yeah.
Levels of who gets reimbursed at what point in the transition. One other comment. You mentioned APEX, and that's great. I appreciate that. But there are other training tools that might be available to you that perhaps you know or don't. But HRSA has funded, although reduced funding for the Public Health Training Center program. Many of them offer very high-quality training, one of which is Public Health Nurse Ready, which will help you in a rural community, particularly in the communicable disease and chronic disease area. And those simply can be accessed through the various training sites or through the PHTC network. So this is a way to get some synergy without additional cost. So I would offer that as a suggestion.
I have a question. I'm not sure that anybody in the room will know the answer, but it would be really nice if you did. Telemedicine, telehealth, that is a service, okay? So is that included within the essential services in the Affordable Care Act? Does anybody know?
It's not a service, it's a modality.
Okay. So then the answer is pretty much no.
Yeah. Well, the way the legislation gets written is if a state decides to uncover it, they say services that are delivered through this modality are reimbursed.
Thank you. Well, Marcia, that's a good question. So you have the same pilot in rural, is that the same as frontier? Because in Oklahoma, we call it rural and frontier, and it's called a different word.
Yes. Okay. 6 per square mile, he said 7, but okay. One community, but they probably live in close proximity to one another, so they might be also.
The part that I found so interesting about that is that they talk about the occupations of that city, and that whole city is listed as white collar, but there's only one job.
I'd like to ask the panelists to speak a little bit on how your agencies, particularly VA and the other groups that you're involved with, can partner with their affiliate public health associations, such as in Maine. Has the VA done anything with the local public health association and the local health system, public health system?
And you heard the question because you're close enough to the microphone. And we do more modest things within the state of Maine in terms of affiliations with our local public health system because we're separate. We truly are separate.
You guys are fabulous.
She's from Maine.
I love you guys. You're out there pushing the edge on.
Well, thank you very much. Oh, thank you. That's very thoughtful. We try.
Okay, so you just got a vote from your public health association.
They're not restricted so much by the federal government, but the people in there are.
Yeah.
Thanks for adding that.
One of the problems that we've experienced in rural with VA is that you're a veteran, and if you're eligible, that's how you access services. Well, if you don't happen to have a CBOC nearby, but you do happen to have a small rural hospital or a small rural clinic, trying to allow people to be seen, that's been a source of a lot of discussion for over the last decade, and I don't know that it's resolved itself or not. You've got your local care that's available, but you need to go be seen by somewhere else. So there's a local pharmacy that's available, but you need to get your drugs back somewhere else. So how do you address that in Maine? Is that still a concern there, or how can you work with local providers?
Yeah, if I can comment, the question revolves our relationship with local providers. And the answer is we do have an answer for that, and that there is a no answer. That's the answer for that. There are some special circumstances where it is easier, for example, patients that have a high degree of a service-connected illness. Right. So if you have something obvious, so that you have a high degree of disability associated with a service-connected illness, we're responsible no matter what. Okay. There are things, for example, called the Millennium Bill that relates to those people who are within the social safety net that is provided by the VA. So for a certain number of our veterans who have no other resources, who end up someplace, we will pick up the tab for that. Okay, we have lots and lots of co-management of our veterans. They have a local provider, you commented on Project Arch, which is in Caribou, Maine. Guess from the name how cold it is up there. Okay, from Caribou, Maine, which is an attempt to have a group of veterans access their care within Cary Medical Center within Caribou. So we're working on that, and it continues to be. It's a huge challenge for us. It's a huge challenge for us.
But enormously creative.
If I could just make a recommendation for those of you. Again, I know I'm from New York State. Actually, I'm the chair of the New York State Rural Health Council, so I have a particular interest in this. Data is going to make all the difference in the world as we move forward. If we do not respond to the need to identify core items that we're going to do measures on, the federal government and our state governments will look at that and say, you cannot demonstrate the need, and therefore there will be no resources. So if you have this, I strongly encourage you to participate in this because your voice is essential. Otherwise, you will watch and see what happens. In New York State right now, we are continuing to lose rural hospitals. And so the challenge gets worse if you don't have the numbers. So please really consider participation in this. Thank you.
It will be posted on the affiliate online community as soon as I get the electronic copy.
We would appreciate your input and participation in the Delphi.
And that's one way we can bring in the local public health associations in each of the states working with the rural health providers. So it's really an awesome opportunity for public health association.
If you saw the state that you're in was one of those that had a reasonable response rate that such that we can use that data, we have to share it with you to put out some additional state-specific information for you to take forward. New York, I think we had 67, 68. I don't recall offhand. But some were particularly large, like Texas and Ohio, had over 150.
Yeah. Another thought that comes to mind is it's not just the public health associations in the state or in New York State Association of County Health Officials, but there are also other organizations that do population-based health work. Chicanes is one. The Healthcare Association of New York State is another one. And these are all robust organizations, many of which have rural representation. So if you're looking to expand the number of those who are involved with this activity outside of the strict governmental public health entities, that would be something I would suggest you consider.
Your insurance.
Yeah.
Sure.
Just one thing to remember, good news or bad news, each census, our numbers, our don't necessarily drop, our proportion drops.
Right.
United States has been growing, but the proportion of that population that live in rural is not as high as it was. It's still millions and millions of people. I live in the fourth largest state in the country with 18 million folks, 10%. 1.8 million people, that is bigger than a lot of states are rural. I need to say that to my state, saying, excuse me. So it's like, we're bigger than Wyoming, bigger than, but it is our voice. The congressmen who have to listen to us, there aren't as many of them anymore. So we need to make our arguments just a lot more clearer and a lot more supported with the data, the science, the evidence, and with all of our stories. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Any other questions? We have time for just a couple more. One more? Okay, one more round of applause. Thank you all.